Okay, good afternoon. My name is Peter Chubb. I'm working with the Gelato project at the University of New South Wales, which is essentially about making Linux run better than Itanium. Today, I'm going to talk about some work we've been doing at Gelato at New South Wales on user mode device drivers, moving device drivers out of the kernel and running them in user space. And if there's two things I want you to get out of this talk, it's first, it's not too hard to expose the extra interfaces you need to make user mode device drivers work. And secondly, the performance that you get from a user mode device driver is not that bad. It's not quite as good as the in-kernel ones, but it's pretty close. So, device drivers in general are a problem. There's an awful lot of them. In fact, in the current kernel, about half the kernel is device drivers. That's counting all the architecture-specific stuff as well. But about half the kernel is device drivers. And those device drivers tend to be a bit buggier than the mainline code because they're not exercised as much. You've got a device driver for some fairly obscure device that only one guy in the world's got. It's not going to get exercised as much as the memory management stuff, which everybody wants to use. And so bugs tend not to be flushed out as quickly. Estimates that I've seen show that about 85% of the bugs in the kernel are driver bugs. The other problem is that drivers use all the internal APIs that the kernel provides, and the kernel changes really fast. I don't know how Linux does it, but the rate of change is so much that you almost can't keep up with it sometimes. The problem then is that not everybody, not all the kernel maintainers, care about every single device out there. And while when they make a change that changes some API, they'll go through and do a grep and search and replace of all the things that will stop the device driver compiling, that doesn't necessarily mean that the driver works after they've finished. So drivers in general tend to be updated a lot slower than the rest of the kernel. So much so that at the moment, around 73 drivers are marked broken in the configuration file. They're the ones that don't compile or don't compile with certain configurations. There's a whole heap more that if you load them as modules, they can't be unloaded because the module API has changed. Thanks, Rusty, is he with you? No. So they can't be unloaded after you finish using them. And there's a whole heap more that even though they work in some circumstances, they're not SMP safe because the rules for locking have changed. Or they're not safe if you turn on preemption because preemptions are going to be a new feature. So drivers are a problem. The other problem with drivers is lack of safety. Drivers, because they run in the kernel address space with as a privileged entity, can access anything in the whole of the memory that's accessible to the kernel and to the user as well, which means that faults in drivers can crash and corrupt the system. Linux is actually pretty good here. Most segmentation violations by drivers will just kill that driver and you can carry on going. But if you're in the middle of an interrupt handle and something goes wrong, it can kill the entire kernel. What's more, the really pernicious bugs are the ones that don't actually crash, they just change something somewhere. So you end up with bad data on your disk, or something like that. Who writes drivers? Well, manufacturers write drivers sometimes. They like writing, they tend to be engineers, not kernel hackers. They don't really understand what's going on in the kernel. And they're usually not computer scientists either, so the code that comes out is pretty appalling sometimes. People who own devices write drivers, but they're probably not kernel hackers either, and they quite often have to reverse engineer some other legacy operating system driver. And sometimes kernel hackers write drivers, often with manufacturer's help. So there's some kernel hacker who's pretty good. A manufacturer will give him an Ethernet card and say, hey, go, write a driver for this, we'll help you. And that's the best case. But even then, the gradual change in the kernel means that the driver gets out of date. result of all this, that most drivers are not written by people who hack on kernels all day, is that in kernel programming it's actually quite hard. It's much harder than user mode programming. For start, it's got to be in C. The kernel's written in C. If you want to stick anything else in there, except assembler, you're really out of luck. I once knew a bloke who wrote a C++ driver, and he had to put so much extra runtime into the kernel that it almost wasn't worth it. You've got to worry about blocking, you've got to worry about preemption, you've got to worry about the internal interfaces, which aren't the same ones that glibc provides. There's a number of functions that look just like glibc ones, but they function slightly differently. So you've got to know all that stuff. And there's all kinds of little idioms that you've got to know about, that if you don't conform to this way of writing stuff, then Linux is never going to accept your patch. I mentioned modules. While you're developing a driver, quite often you do have a module that can't be unloaded, and so you do crash a lot, and rebooting any kind of real machine is slow. The normal debuggers aren't available, so you can't just use GDB on your driver. Well, you sort of can, but you can't single step or anything like that. There are kernel debuggers, KDB and GDB, for some kernels on some platforms, but it's not part of the mainline yet. And you really, really need a serial console, which means you've got to have two boxes. You're going to have one to do all your development on, and another one to do your testing on. So in kernel programming is hard. The Linux kernel mailing list is a frequently asked questions about why you can't do interrupt processing in user mode. Unfortunately, it's out of date too. What it says is that user process run with interrupts enabled, just any interrupt handler must deactivate the particular interrupt source before the process is scheduled to run, or the interrupt storm results. That's not quite true anymore, because the standard IRQ handler within the kernel disables the interrupt that you just got for you before you have to do anything. So this one's not true anymore, so we can write user mode interrupt handlers now. Okay, so where could you put a driver? Well, this is where the traditional driver sits. It's in the kernel address space, and it runs with kernel privilege. Even today, there are drivers that run on off basis. There's some work by the University of Washington called Nooks. It creates what they call lightweight protection domains, which are essentially protected address spaces that run with kernel privilege. And they take ordinary Linux drivers and stick them in those protected address spaces. Unfortunately, normal drivers access all kinds of bits of other kernel infrastructure, and they expect to be able to get at X time, for example, to do timing and jitters and things like that. To get around that, the Nooks work makes copies of those at each entry point. So when you enter the protection domain, it copies all the relevant data variables that are used into the protection domain. Yeah, that's right. The question was timing gets a bit corrupted. Yes, it does. It's also a performance hit, and they're seeing 5-10% off the performance. You could also put a device driver in a separate address space and talk via a socket or a shared memory segment to other things that want to use you. X3 is the obvious example of this. X3 talks to the kernel It talks to the device by mapping bits of device memory through the AGP stuff, and then it talks to the rest of the world via a socket, and then it drives the video card directly. So you can put a device driver in a separate user process. Or you could link your device driver with the user process that wants to use that device. And that's what all the Xsane tools do. There's a library that contains the drivers for all the different kinds of scanners you can get. And then it talks to the SCSI bus via the SCSI general thing. But the effect is that the device driver is linked with the user process. So you don't have to have it in the kernel. So my claim is that user mode drivers lead to easier development, because you're not developing in kernel, easier deployment, and I'll come to that in a minute. It can lead to more robust system as a whole, because a single driver crashing doesn't take out the whole system, ever. It can lead to more functionality, because there's things you can do in user space that you wouldn't dream of doing inside the kernel. Recursive algorithms are a real no-no in the kernel, because you've got limited stack space, for example. And user mode drivers can be simpler because they haven't got to be quite as robust with regard to error handling and so forth, because they haven't got to handle all the weird chips that's out there. You can make specific user mode drivers for specific things without unduly bloating things. Easy to experiment. You can use any IDE, any language, even Python. They know that man at the back, he wrote an IDE driver in Python using our infrastructure, and it works. I guess you could be a masochist too. No reboots. If you've got your driver in user mode, you can just self-kill 9 to it. And it stops. Because it's a process, the kernel releases all its resources for you. You don't need to worry about that, they're all tracked. And then you can just rerun it. Well, almost rerun, no reboots. Because you're doing DMA, and if you screw up your DMA descriptors, you can DMA somewhere and cause a crash. You don't really need to understand the Linux in-kernel semantics. So that's half of the problem of writing a driver and gone. You do still have to understand the hardware, and that is the other half of the problem. And that's even worse because quite a lot of manufacturers don't actually publish the details you need to write a driver. Where you need to use some of Trigi's magic discovery techniques, write everything to every page and see what happens. Easier deployment. In-kernel interfaces change really fast. None of the kernel developers have any real interest in keeping them constant, where that would get in the way of some new feature. But the kernel-to-user API changes really slowly. It generally changes by adding a new feature, rather than by getting rid of old ones. And the old ones tend to be really stable for years at a time. So if you've got a device driver that runs in user mode using the standard kernel APIs, it's much more likely to still work when we get to 2.7, 2.8, 2.9 kernels. This also means that it's possible to distribute drivers in binary. Out-of-tree drivers are a real problem at the moment. If you want to distribute an out-of-tree driver, you've got to distribute it as source. And that means that the person who gets the driver needs to have a complete development system on his box in order to build the driver and install it to match his kernel. It also means there aren't any license hassles. If I want to release my driver under the MIT license instead of the GNU license, I can. Well, not really. It's linked with the kernel, it's got to be GPL. You can use your normal package management. You haven't got to do something special, like the hacks that Debian put in for loadable modules. So what do you actually need? Well, first of all, you need to be able to get at the PCI config space to find out whether your device is there, which ports it uses, which memory map regions it uses, and which interrupts it uses. That's already there. There's a /proc/bus/PCI, has all that information in there. And there's a nice little library that comes from the PCI utils that lets you get at it in a really easy way. You also need to be able to get at the port space or the MMIO space. Well, you can use INBI and OUTBI and all their friends, providing your port is below 65,000 or something. But if you put your device in the wrong slot on the PCI bus, then you're going to be using ports above that and you're not going to be able to get it anymore. There's a patch by Albert Callahan that makes it relatively straightforward to do the equivalent of NMAP on either port space or MMIO space through /proc/bus/PCI. That's not in the mainline kernel yet. I hope it will be sometime. But the other things you need are some ways to get at interrupts, some ways to get at to set up DMA, and some way to loop back the top of your user mode block device into the kernel so all the file systems can find it. So they're the three things that we're working on now. Interrupts is essentially complete. DMA, I've got a proof of concept. And the loopback, we've got one really hacked up, horrible example, and we're working on more. So, interrupts. Oh no, before that, let's have a look at what drivers look like. This is a typical block device driver. There's the driver there. It's a horrible colour, don't worry about it. It talks to the block layer above it. And the blocks layer says, okay, do this, that, or the other. It then talks to the PCI DMA services to say, okay, I've got this request to do something, to read some stuff off the disk. I need to convert all those virtual addresses I've got into physical addresses, and or actually into PCI bus addresses, and give me and get a scatter and gather list that I can give to the device. So it talks to PCI DMA services. One of the things that the PCI DMA services can give you is a lump of consistent memory that you can put your scatter list in, so the device can see it and you can see it, and any changes you may make can be seen by the device and vice versa. So the driver then takes the scatter list, converts it to whatever device-specific format it's got, sticks it into the shared memory, and tells the hardware, off you go, shoo! The hardware then DMAs back into wherever the block layer told it to put the stuff as per the scatter list, and eventually generates an interrupt. The interrupt goes through some low-level interrupt handling, and eventually does a call back into the driver. And then the driver can tell the hardware, ah, yes, we've got an interrupt from you, cancel the interrupt, what's your status, has it finished properly, and then tell the block layer that everything's taken care of. So that's more or less what a driver looks like when it's in the kernel. So as you can see, we've got the bits we actually need to add are some way to allocate this consistent shared memory, some way to get DMA to give it a virtual address, translate it into a scatter list of bus addresses, and some way to detect, to register for an interrupt and to handle it when you get it. Interrupts. I've been measuring really tremendous interrupt latencies on both Itanium and Pentium, using a very simple device that's just got a little timer in it, that when the timer expires, it generates an interrupt, and then when you acknowledge it, it resets the counter and generates another one after a little while. Sticking a crow on that to find out how fast you can acknowledge the interrupt, I'm seeing approximately 10 microseconds on a 2.5 gig machine. I actually think that's appalling. Pardon? That's both in kernel, and it's only a little tiny bit more for user mode. So that's the first problem with interrupts. Yep, Trish? It does seem awfully long, and I haven't tried that. And it seems to be a PCI bus specific thing, because I saw bus you seem to be able to get less than 1 microsecond. Okay. Anyway, the big question is, how do we communicate interrupts up to the user space? Well, an interrupt looks a lot like a signal. So theoretically, you could have a system call that says, okay, when this interrupt arrives, I'm interested in this interrupt, when it arrives, give me a signal. The problem then is tidying up. How do I deregister? You can add another system call that say, I'm not interested in this interrupt anymore, but you really want to make it so that when the protest dies, all interest in the interrupt goes away. So there's something wrong there. You could use a shared event buffer and something in there like a putex or something so that you can go to sleep on it. That would probably work. Or you could use a file descriptor, because the kinds of things you want to do with signals feels a bit like file operations. And that's the one I chose to implement in the proof of concept that we worked on. This is what we want to be able to do. First, we want to be able to say, I'm interested in interrupt PCI. And while I'm interested in it, nobody else can get it. Shared interrupts at user level are a really bad idea. And you want to be able to unregister interrupts. Okay, I'm about to design. I'm going to do a program shutdown. So I want to say, okay, I don't want that interrupt anymore. Or you want to be able to do it automatically when your user mode driver dies. At that point, you want to say, okay, I'm not interested in this interrupt anymore. This is feeling very much like file descriptors, as you see. And you want the user code to be informed when the interrupt happens, somehow. What's more, you want to be able to mask and unmask that interrupt. You want to be able to say, okay, I'm not interested in interrupts during this period. So, this is what we actually implemented. I hacked into the architecture-specific IRQ routine that puts up the proc interrupt number. It's then there for SNP affinity. I extended that, first of all, to create the directory for all the interrupts, not just the ones that are currently registered, and add an extra file, IRQ, into each of those directories. So then you can open it with the appropriate privilege, of course. So what that does is it says, it registers a little tiny subhandler in the kernel for this interrupt, and it remembers in the file system type structure that we've got it. We've got the interrupt. And then, when we actually want to enable the interrupt and get it, we just call read on it. That unmasks the interrupt. If the interrupt has already occurred by then, we'll just wake up straight away. But otherwise, we do the down on the semaphore, and that puts you to sleep if there hasn't been an interrupt since the last time you did this. Otherwise, you'll just go straight through. And when the interrupt happens, it ups the semaphore and disables it in the ASIC. And then the read returns. So that's a very, very simple way to ask, okay, wait now for an interrupt to happen in driver land. And on close, you mask the interrupts and then release the interrupt line. And that close could be either explicit or when the process dies. Typically, the way we've been using this is have a real-time thread that loops. It just reads from the interrupt file descriptor, acknowledges the interrupt to the device, queues any new work to the device, calls the client callback to say, okay, we're finished, and then goes back to read again, wait for the next interrupt. So it's a very small, simple, fairly tight loop. We're trying to minimize the latency. We've got preemption on. We're running as a real-time thread. Providing you're using mmapped port space, you can drop your privilege after you've opened the IRQFD. So you can run as an ordinary user at that point. So that adds a little bit to safety. It works reasonably well. The latency is not measurably increased by doing all this stuff, even though you've got an extra context switch. Instead of just switching directly from whatever process was running into the kernel, which then calls the driver, you've now got running whatever was running, switches into the kernel, which does the up, which causes a context switch to the user process, which is the driver, which then runs. So you've got an extra context switch in there. I'm measuring context switches around about 2 microseconds. So that's not too bad. DMA is a different matter. This is what the system sort of looks like. You've got a PCI bus there, and the device handles off that. You've got the consistent memory that I mentioned earlier. It's the memory that both device and CPU can see, and can both see at the same time. And then you've got what I'm calling DMAable memory. That's anything that is within the range that the PCI bus can address, say the first 24 bits width, depending on your device. And between the processor and the DMA memory, you've got a cache, some sort. When the processor wants to talk to that memory, it just talks and caches stuff as it goes. When the device wants to talk to the memory, it talks directly to it. So you've got to have some mechanism to say, okay, make sure what's in my cache really got to memory before you do the DMA. And you want to do that anyway for stuff after you finish a DMA into memory. Say, okay, my cache is probably invalid by now for some of those addresses. So you've got the problem of unidirectional, that's the ones where you've got to do the caching stuff, or bidirectional DMA, that's the one with the consistent memory. For accessing memory outside the range that your device can address, because some devices are only 24-bit or some devices are only 32-bit, you use either an IOMMU or a bounce buffer into low memory, which is another reason why you need to do some setup before the VMA and some clear down afterwards. Just because memory is virtually contiguous doesn't mean it's physically contiguous, so you need also to convert your virtual address plus length into a set of pages with offsets and things. And some IO MMUs need to know the PCI device ID, just to know which button it's on to do the learning properly. So this is what things actually look like then. You've got your devices, then some kind of IO MMU, into main memory, and on the other end you've got your CPU, MMU and cache. So the IO MMU does almost exactly the same thing as your MMU does, but for PCI space, not CPU space. When your device wants to do DMA, it DMAs through the IOMMU. This means that you can stop your device driver, your untrusted user mode device driver, from doing random DMA into anywhere, because you make sure that the IOMMU only sets up the translations you really care about. And so it can't actually get into things. If you've got more than one device, though, the IOMMU doesn't distinguish which device requests are coming from, so you can still get some crosstalk there, but the likelihood is much reduced. Unfortunately, the IOMMU introduces a little latency, and it costs a bit to set up. It's a few tens of nanoseconds extra latency on each transport and transfer. So what the Linux kernel does at the moment is, if the device can actually address the memory you're interested in, it bypasses the IOMMU. For a really secure user mode driver, you never want to be able to do that. Fortunately, there's a config option that lets you fix that. So, what does it look like from the user mode driver's point of view? Well, you've got this user PCI open system call. What it does is it calls PCI enabled device and PCI set master. Say, okay, we've got a new device, it's enabled, it's driver. It also remembers that you've done it so that other people don't do the same thing. And because the way in Linux is to use file systems for almost everything, this creates an inode credential in the user of their file system and returns the file descriptor for that. Close does exactly the opposite. It disables the device, which stops the DMA. It unmaps all the DMA mappings and releases all the scatter lists and releases all the other things that you've got hold of, and then it finally returns. So that's a way to map all the sources you're using. Now, when you want to actually do DMA, you can call setup DMA. This dev is whatever you've got returned from user PCI open dev. The address and size are the address in your address space and the length that you want to set up. A DMA bus handles an opaque type because we use the same one for requests coming in from the kernel and requests coming from something else in the same address space. And the direction is whether we're going from the device to the memory or the other way around. It converts a contiguous area of VM to a scatter list of addresses from the bus by calling PCI DMA map SG inside the kernel. Teardown DMA does exactly the opposite. So in use, what do you do? You find out where your device is by calling libPCI, and that gives you your IO port addresses, your IO queue number, and which bus slot you're on. You then call PCI, use the PCI open, do anything you need to do to initialize the driver, which normally gives you some sort of handle. Create an interrupt thread, which sets up the real-time thread that listens to that IRQ and calls back to the callback function when it's found it. Do whatever you need to do to wait for your requests to come in or whatever. And at some stage you want to allocate a persistent area of memory, so you say use a PCI allocate persistent. And then you call setup DMA in a loop for your buffer. Convert the buffer sorry, the stuff you get back from setup DMA into a DMA table that the device can understand. Remember, the DMA table was returned by Alex consistency, consistent memory. Setup DMA returns the scatter list, so it takes back the address and the length and sticks them in the table. Then you tell the device to do the DMA, however you manage to do that, that's driver business. Then you wait for the interrupt. Or normally in this thread, you don't have to do that, you go up and wait for another request from somewhere else and wait for the callback. Anyway, when the interrupt happens, you tear down the DMA, and this is the kind of result that you're getting. This is for a user mode IDE driver for a Silicon Image CMD680 chipset IDE driver, talking to a Maxtor 50 gig disk. These lines here, they're throughput. The dotted blue line is the standard kernel driver. That's the kind of throughput we're getting with a different transfer size using O2X. So we're trying to bypass the buffer count at this point. This line here is the amount of CPU used during that time for the kernel mode driver on this scale here. So what you can see is that using Linux threads, which is the green line that you can hardly see, we get slightly worse performance than with new processor thread library. But either way, by the time you get to a decent amount of decent sized requests, 64K, the performance is identical between user mode and kernel mode, and we're actually using slightly less CPU, just a tad less. The reason for that slight tad less is that the kernel refuses to use more than 128K at a time in a DMA request, whereas our driver uses the full range that the device has. And that's why you get that little blip there too, because that's where you suddenly start doing two interrupts per transfer instead of one. Okay, that looks really nice. What I can't understand, and if anybody here does, I'd be very happy to talk to you afterwards, is why this is decreasing. When you actually do the work turn this graph upside down, both kernel and user mode are using 42 microseconds per interrupt, approximately. Given that they're both using the same amount of CPU, how come we're getting worse throughput? There's some extra latency there, and the only thing I can think of at the moment is that even though we're running a real-time interrupt thread, it's not getting scheduled straight away after the up happens on the semaphore. But I don't know why. We've got preemption on, it should be the highest priority thread in the system. Does this amount of lack of latency really, lack of throughput really matter? That was the next question. So we hacked up a loopback so you could make this user mode driver look like a standard blocking device. It's a real hack, but you can get off the web page if you're interested. And these are the only Bonnie differences. Bonnie results that really differ significantly. All the others, they were within 0.1 of a standard deviation from each other, so there wasn't much point putting them up. And you can see that even here, it's almost exactly the same except for the random delete. All the rest are sort of within cooey of each other. And what that shows is that the page is actually really good at hiding latency. So, What I think you've seen here is that kernel support for user mode drivers is possible, and the performance is perfectly adequate for IDE. We have got some preliminary results for Ethernet, and what we're seeing there is that the in-kernel drivers suck for gigabit Ethernet at the moment. Mainly, by the way, all these results are on a Titanium thread. Mainly because the driver doesn't realign the payload, and so all your IP traffic is done using unaligned accesses, which cause a trap back into the kernel to fix up the unaligned access each time. And that causes a really poor performance. Pardon? The RTL, which one was it, Benno? tell you after. Yeah. So where are we going to here? Here. You can fetch the patch now from the Gelato website. What I'm planning to do in the very near future is a code cleanup to make it possibly submissible for 2.7. The actual amount of code that changed is really small. It's almost entirely in the architecture-specific DWIRQ version. There's a fair bit of code added to do all the DMA stuff, because there's a new file system there. I want to experiment with MMIO support. I haven't done that yet. We've only been doing programmed IO support, mainly because the cards we're using, we can get documentation for programmed IO stuff, and there's no documentation for the MMIO stuff. So, I want to merge the system calls. At the moment, to set up DMA and then to tear it down again each time is two system calls. Most times when you're in a driver, if you tear down the DMA, you're only going to set it up again in a minute, very soon. So why not have a single system call that both tears down and sets up the DMA? That would also have the performance advantage that it's quite likely that your scatter list information is already in cache, so you can reuse the same one. And let's start doing some reliability tests. I've claimed right at the beginning that a user mode driver can be more reliable than an internal driver, but we haven't actually done any rigorous testing to show that this is the case. It feels that way. It's quite hard to crash the system just by putting artificial driver bugs in, or real ones where you've made some stupid mistakes. But it'd be really nice to have some formal test results for reliability. And we want some more drivers. We're not just taking the in-kernel drivers out seeking in user space, because the in-kernel drivers already rely on all that stuff that the Linux kernel provides. What we want is ones that rely just on glibc with this extra system call or two that we're providing. And some more loopbacks. I've got a really hacked-up loopback for blocked devices. It would be nice to have that for character devices and network devices too, so you can use the in-kernel stack. But I suspect that the real advantage for user mode Ethernet devices is going to be when you have an application-specific protocol stack and you want to link your driver in the bottom and avoid using the kernel TCP/IP stack entirely. And how about some user mode file systems? How about taking libx2 and running your entire file system in user space? That's something else that we're thinking about trying. And let's get some real performance measurements from the network drivers that we've got and write some new ones. Okay, that's the end of my talk. Have you got any questions? Yep. Yes. The current implementation uses read because that lets you combine the idea of unmasking the interrupt and waiting for it to happen. With select, all you've got, the only information you've got is that there's something happening on this file descriptor. And you need something else to say, okay, I'm interested in this file, I'm interested in this interrupt. So you'd need to have two system calls, not just one. You could theoretically have it. I could add the pull routines to the file system bit to let you do that, but I haven't done it yet. And I'm unsure it would actually work on it. Trish? Right. You can't guarantee that the interrupt's going to return in a reasonable time to go on to the next thing. So if you've got, at the moment, what shared interrupts do is it calls the handler for each one. Now, I've got a little tiny stub there that just masks the interrupt, says I've handled it, and calls wake up. If you shared the interrupt, it would always say, okay, this, we've handled it, even though the user space hasn't actually done it yet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Yeah, you could do that. I'd have to think about that. Yep. Yeah. Well, yeah. The only issue there is if the interrupt's shared by more than one, by things that aren't handled by this driver. Because if it's handled by this driver, it's going to have to look at the status of registers anyway to find out what's happened. And that's true whether it's a single function interrupt or got many different purposes. Yeah. Okay. Any others? Yeah. Can you speak up a bit, please? Okay. This is a hack. What I've done is defined a new file system that you mount on slash something, and it's got two halves. It's got a client half and a master half. And when you do that, the driver opens the master half and registers, and that registers a block device with the block device stuff. And then it can read and write or select or whatever on that file descriptor to have things happen. And when the partitioning happens, devices appear automatically in the slave half, where, because for each master file descriptor, the slave selects. And so you get different files in there, each of which is a block device that you can then look at this and mount. So essentially, it's a little protocol that reads and writes to a threading user space. Yeah, so the buffers are all kept in kernel space, and there's a slight modification to the protocol so that instead of passing virtual addresses to the driver, we pass scatter lists that's already been created. Because the block layer almost does that for you. Yep. Could be, but I thought the tap device was deprecated. There's some new tap, I don't know what it is. Any more? Yep. You unlock it. Yep, any more? But the nice thing is, you can do all your setup. You can do all your setup as root, as a privileged process, and then drop almost all your privileges when you're actually doing the work, which makes the user mode driver a lot safer than the corresponding internal driver. We did an IDE driver because it is something that's fairly latency critical, although the page cache did a really good job of hiding the page. All right? Yep, one more, please. Yeah. Well, one of the things we're thinking about doing is putting ALCID out of the kernel. Because I find the ALCID code and the OSS code really big, probable, and it shouldn't really be in the kernel. It doesn't need to be. So let's pull it out and put either an ESD or a JAX interface on the front of it. No, not yet. I thought he might be here, but he's not. Okay. Well, if you want to take two things away from this, one, user mode drivers are possible, and two, they don't hurt you.